Hi, my name is Nancy. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Nancy.
Wow, you look like such a great group. You're good looking, and anybody can laugh for 5 minutes over the word relationship looking for a good time. I watched you. Man, everybody loves that word. Well, I'm really thrilled to be here, and I'm very grateful, and I want to thank Betsy for inviting me to share, and of course all of you. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share my story in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they told me you can't keep it unless you give it away. So, and I believe them. So it's been working for 23 years. I got sober on June 28th, 1976. I was three. And I still work on honesty and all that stuff. So actually, you know, I really do love this program. I love the laughter. I love the eyes. Wherever I get to go, I see the same intent, you know. And I mean, this thing is so special that we do, and you know, you hear people say, I wonder why it works. Why does this work? Why does it? I say, well, read the book, you know how it works. Why does it work? I found the neatest paragraph in the book just a little while ago, and I love to read it to start. But I have like 16 pairs of glasses now in my life, and I lost the one pair that would help me read this for you. So if anybody has a pair of reading glasses I could borrow for a second. Are they 1.75? No.
It may be.
Isn't that funny? Okay. You know. No cameras, please. Okay. There we go. I knew I was in trouble when they laughed at relationship. I knew it. Man, are you going to laugh a lot tonight? Okay. Now listen, you know, somebody says, well, why does AA work? And in this paragraph, just a little paragraph, on page 18, at the bottom of the page, it says that the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou. Nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. That there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. I think that's why it works. I don't know, I guess this paragraph's been here for a while, but it was new to me. You're going to be there for a while? I got to find my glasses. Anyway, I think, of course, if there's anyone here for their first speaker meeting, which is possible always, I need to tell you and share again that anything I say in meeting is my experience. It's not the program. It's my experience as a member of this program. Hopefully there'll be some recovery in here, but I have a lot of theories, and one of my theories is that I was not simply a born alcoholic. I was actually a prenatal alcoholic. And I have evidence for this theory. My evidence is that my mom carried me for 10 months. It's my first act of procrastination and defiance. I must have my little fins pressed up against the uterine walls going, no, I don't want to be born. And then I was born, dumped out into the universe, an Irish Catholic and a victim, of course. And another alcoholic was launched into the universe. And I started working on my neurotic problems and so forth. I was the youngest of three girls, and my dad died when I was 18 months old. And I was a strong Irish mom. And they had just driven out to California from Pennsylvania. My dad was a writer. And he got a big job on the Los Angeles Times, and he had these little girls. And the house there was in kind of a nice area in Glendale, and it was filled with writers and intellectuals and musicians, and they were living this dream come true for my mom, and then he just died on the kitchen floor. And my mom had sisters back in Pennsylvania, and they all said, well, we'll each take a girl, but my mom said, no, I want to keep them, I'm going to bring them up here. It was really tough to do in the 50s to be a single parent. Yeah, but my mom did it. And I grew up without a dad, and I spent a lot of time in my head making up stories. And I loved singing. When I was 5 years old, I discovered I had a gift for music, and it really comforted me. I love singing. I think music is just lovely, and it was the most spiritual thing I could do. And I went to Catholic school, and I was a good girl. And when I was 13 years old, tragedy struck. Puberty set in. And I had no information. So, I didn't know anything about boys, didn't know anything about dates, didn't know anything about puberty. All I knew was that I was tall. And I had to walk at the end of the line at Catholic school with the other tall girl, and that wasn't any fun. So something happened to me, and I staged this rebellion that some of us in Alcoholics Anonymous know a lot about. And I just went crazy overnight. I went from running around being a good girl, getting good grades and doing the right thing. Just overnight I went over here and I started running around with the other gangsters in Catholic school. And they thought I was funny. And they filled me in on the boys and dates and sex and makeup and all this stuff. And we started having fun. And I just loved it. Those good people weren't having this kind of fun. This was really fun. And the next, we stole some vodka from my best friend's mom, and we took it into the bathroom at 10:15 recess. And I started mixing those drinks. Now, I always think of my first drink, because I've never forgotten my first drink. Have you forgotten yours? I mean, it's like most alcoholics really remember their first drink. It was such a miracle. Even before I drank the drink, I started to get the miracle of the fast lane life that I wanted to live. Because, you know, well, I was in this little bathroom with my little friends, and you're not supposed to be in the bathroom when you're 13 years old mixing screwdrivers, you know. It's a crime, so to speak. And but there was a thrill of maybe getting caught. We shared that thrill, you know, it's like, oh, you might get caught. And that was really, and I loved that. I loved the possibility and the danger there. And then when we drank the drink, my disease exploded right away. I didn't have to go into training for alcoholism. It seemed to work right away because it went in and all my DNA said, yes. And I felt better right away. And I wanted more right away. And I suddenly got to be very good looking with one drink. A lot of adolescent problems faded away. And I had a lot to say. And I felt the power inside me. And I was deeply moved by my first drink. And then the bell rang. And we went back to religion class. And I sat in the back of the room that day and I turned my will and my life over to the bottle. I didn't know those words, but I knew I was going to be dedicated to that discovery. And the next year I was in public school, and I started working on my image, and I used to, you know, I was trying to be a bad girl. And so I ratted my hair really high so people would think I had weapons in there. And I wore an awful lot of makeup. I mean, just really quite a bit of makeup. In fact, in the 60s, okay, mathematicians out there. But in the 60s, we used to wear this white lipstick. I see heads nodding, so I'm going to take a moment for some massage. Your lips were so white they came in the room before you did. I've still got mine, you know. It's coming back. I just know it'll be back. And I wore all these crazy clothes, you know, the beatniks were on their way out and hippies were on their way in, and I was caught on a fashion cusp, and it was, and I started to expand my juvenile delinquency, and I became a thief. I used to steal. I thought it was okay to steal from institutions because they deserve to be stolen from. And I fancied myself a kind of a Robin Hood, you know. Except that broke down to another half measure, because Robin Hood would steal from the rich and give to the poor. Well, Nancy Hood would steal from the rich and it gets stopped right here. It was like, just could not give it out. So that's what I did. And I discovered older boys, and there were lots of drinking was going on, and school got in the way of all these various activities. I discovered Hollywood that year because I lived in a little, at the time it was a little burg in California called Glendale. I thought Hollywood is a great cure for living in Glendale. So I ran away to Hollywood all the time, and I started breaking my mother's heart. I saw my first therapist when I was 15 years old. And of course my academics went just out the window. Glendale High School gave me what they call D stops. A D stop means we'll pass you but never come back here again. Out, out, out. And but I had Hollywood now, and my great discovery in Hollywood were these, they had these great coffee houses in the 60s in Hollywood. I don't know, they've got coffee houses. Do you have Starbucks here? And they're everywhere, aren't they? Well, I have to pause for a moment of definition because some people were born in the 70s in the room. And let me just tell you that the coffee houses in the 60s were not Starbucks. It was a whole different experience in there. Boy, they were about as big as this stage. And smoky in there, and dark, and you stuck to all the furniture. You know, no one ever washed cups, and no one ever discussed it. It was just kind of, and these were great places, and it was the people that I loved the most, because they had these wild people in these coffee houses. They were like artists and writers and druggies and political people and people just kind of broken people. It was just a lot like an AA meeting. And I've always loved us, you know, so I fit right in. I was just like them. I was just one of those broken people. And so I like hanging around there. But mostly they had this music going on in these coffee houses. Because you remember, the 60s was that time when the culture just cracked and everything shifted. I think of it as like plates in geography, right? Topography, whatever, when the plates move. Well, I'm from California, so I think about this stuff a lot. And when and the plates move and the surface changes, and so the culture was doing that, and the plates were moving and the surface was changing everywhere. But music especially, because this new thing was happening to all of us in some sense in the 60s. It was really happening in music, and I loved protesting. There was lots of protest music. Now, I never knew anything about the war, but I loved protesting. I did finally learn about the 60s in 1987. They had a class at Cal State Fullerton. The class was called America in the 60s. So I signed up for that. And I had these wonderful textbooks, and I learned about civil rights and women's rights. We went to the moon. It was like, wow, what a great decade. And All the other students who were the right age looked at me and said, well, you were there. And I said, no, I wasn't, not really. So, I have a great way of excusing myself from this obvious lack, and that is, I've met some people in AA who've lost a few decades, and they can't take a class in there, so nanny nanny. I got my way. Anyway, back then I was just this lost young person, and but I didn't know that. I felt good when I could go there and drink and sing, you know, puff the magic dragon. It was really, really exciting stuff. And I've been thrown out of NA meetings when I tell that story, you know, have you know? You're nothing but a grape! Get out of here! So anyway, I was really drinking then, and I was carrying on, I was just smoking marijuana, and I was taking pills, and I was taking LSD and all this thing, and just, you know, and like I said, school just went away, and I broke my mother's heart. When I was 17 years old, I reached a stage of my drinking where I was talking to my car. Intimate confidence, you know, and I was trying to come home one night in my car, you know, and I said, we got to come down, and my car agreed. And I went into one last coffee house, and it was, and my life changed. In this little room about as big as this stage, where all these musicians jammed in there, and they were jamming, and it was rock and roll. Of course, jazz had been jamming for years, but like I said, music was shifting and exploding. These rockers were jamming. And they were wonderful. This was before we had the term multicultural. Okay, they were from everywhere. Every skin color was there, and they played everything. They had bongos and a cello, and they had a flute, and they had a piano, and they only had one guitar, and all they had a paraplegic in the wheelchair who played the cymbals. He didn't play them on time, and no one cared. And they were playing in this great key of go. It was this sound. And you have to remember that rock and roll was sort of static, and there were three guitars and a drummer. So this was like unbelievable, and I just fell in love. And I stood up in the middle of the room, and I started singing. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. So we did that a lot. And there were 26 of them, and they were called Jay Walker and the Pedestrians. My first Jay Walker before I came across this guy, you know. Anyway, this went on, and it was crazy, and I floated away, and that night, and I got kicked out of Glendale College, just kind of moved along out of there. I got a scholarship to the California Institute of the Arts and Music, and it meant nothing to me. I was already the ABCs in Chapter 5. I was already beyond human aid, and I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it, and I was living the life I wanted to live, and I never wanted anything but to just drink and play. That was all I wanted. And eight of those pedestrians, we broke away from Jay Walker, and we set up in a little house in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, and that summer was the summer of love. We got together as a band, and we argued about how to be a band and what to call ourselves, and we wrote 3 45-minute sets, and instead of going to college, that fall we opened up for Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company at the Whiskey, and we called ourselves Sweetwater, and we were in Georgia. Shortly thereafter, we traveled back to the Atlanta Pop Festival. Everybody remember that? My first taste of Atlanta, and I loved it. But anyway, we had a ball, and we caught on, and people really loved our show. We had a great show. We were very musical. We were really something to see, and we got it. We played all over the country. I remembered Atlanta, but, you know. Was it luck, you know? Because actually, I don't remember a lot of it. We were everywhere. We played all the rock rooms, Fillmore East and West, and all the pop festivals, the first one in Miami, and we played... We were the first band to take the stage at Woodstock in 1969. But they cut us out of the movie. AA is the only place where that's funny. We are such a sick bunch. You know? I killed my grandfather. That's good. Oh. Earth people say, oh, that's too bad. You might have had a whole career out of that. Yeah. Anyway. What happened inside of me as a person and as a little alcoholic in training here, I want to describe just kind of a mood inside of me was I felt, on the one hand, I felt really arrogant. You know, and it says that some of us alcoholics have trouble with success. And so I felt pretty arrogant, like I showed everybody who'd ever been mean to me that they missed out on the rock star. You know, what am I now? But, you know, at the same time inside of me, I had the opposite feeling. And I could be ticked into that with just a look. And that feeling was terror that you'd find out I wasn't any good at all. You know? We either have to be above everybody or we are become doormats, right? The book talks about that. And that's what I had inside of me all the time. We did all these television shows and everything. 4 months after Woodstock, 3 days after we had done the Red Skelton show, I was almost killed by a drunk driver, and I was on the freeway, and he hit my car, and I made an accordion out of my Buick, and I pushed that steel up 6 inches with my head, and I was in a coma for 10 days. I was taken to Glendale Memorial Hospital on the one night of the month when all the neurologists of Southern California are having their meeting, all the head doctors. And they all worked on my head. And they all said, this girl will not live. No one can survive a blow like that. And all Irish family came, and I had the last rites and everything. Once I was telling this story, and somebody said, so did you live? Hoping to see one of those doctors one of these days in here, you know. But when I didn't die right away, they said if she lives, she'll be a vegetable. So I your Friday night artichoke. I had brain damage for the next 12 years. It's all over. I'm okay. But my first 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had brain problems. I had petit mal seizures and so forth. And I like to share that. I like to tell you that sobriety just did wonders for me. My brain had a chance to heal once I stopped putting all that crap in it. You know, and if someone is here tonight with some kind of physical problem, I hope I can encourage you not to despair, because I was supposed to have brain damage for the rest of my life. So, I have, however, permanently lost the use of one of my vocal cords. And I had 6 operations on my throat. The singer, right? And I was in the hospital for 2 months. And I got out of the hospital, and I was so devastated by this, I couldn't feel it. You know how we are? I guess maybe that's where denial becomes something that helps you through things. I don't know. Again, there's another one of my theories. But Sweetwater was completely devastated by this. And we patched together two more albums, and then the group fell apart because they just couldn't wait for me to rehabilitate. I started working with a doctor and a coach because I did not know how to live. If I couldn't drink and sing, why would I want to live? Because I thought that was my job. I thought my job was to sing. So I worked with a doctor and a coach, and I started running around in Hollywood trying to be hip, slick, and cool, and I never, ever have been very good at it. But I gave it my best shot, and my drinking got heavy, and I eventually got a new record deal, and I got a lot of money, and I got a rock and roll palace in Laurel Canyon, and I paid cash for Mercedes, and the disease of alcoholism was just like the book says, potential females are often, female alcoholics are often gone beyond recall, you know, and that was to be my experience. I was taking this anti-seizure medicine, and I was taking Dexedrine and Dalmane, and my new record came out, and a year later the company went belly up, and I was on my own again, and I was getting tired because the disease was getting worse. I was starting to experience not knowing how this drunk would be. There were times at the end of my drinking where I could drink two glasses of wine and be really smashed. And there were other days when I'd be full of alcohol and not be drunk. Those were terrible days when your best friend doesn't work. I always saw shrinks and I never told the truth. And the book says many of us are like that. We just don't know how to give these good doctors a break. And I was one of those people. I just paid them $100 to listen to me go, rah, 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 rah. And when my record company went belly up, I was worried about my image. So I met a woman who drank like me, and she had a little office, a temporary office business on Sunset Boulevard, office help. So we drank together, and we got drunk one day, and I said, if we put a phone in your office, and if it rings, will you be my secretary? And she said, sure. And I didn't have it in me to put together another band. I was really tired. And you know, when you're in the getting towards the bottom part of alcoholism, people are always picking on you, and you're always paranoid. And musicians always want to change your stuff, and to heck with them. And I just started playing my own piano. And I met a bass player who smoked a lot of pot and lost the power of speech. And I thought, well, we'd be good together. I tried booking us around, and I was working my way into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea. One day I was drinking with a secretary, and she got sick, and I was helping her, thinking she ought to join my health club or whatever, and you know, she ought to do it my way, whatever. And she called me the next day and said she joined AA, and I said, you're fired. And I was on my own, and I was down to, I had no love in my life. Before Alcoholics Anonymous, I truly had no love in my life because I was not a loving person. I didn't know how to be a loving person. And AA has shown me how to be a loving person, has shown me how to care about other people. You know, but before that, I mean, I didn't have any boyfriends. I knew how to have sex, but I did not know how to be a loving person. And I didn't have any relationship with my mom or my sisters. They didn't know how to talk to me. Nobody did. Because the delusion was so active in my mind, I was really crazy. And my only companions were two gay guys who were drug addicts. And they didn't drink my wine, and they cleaned my house. But the greatest loss when I drank away the music. Because the day arrived at the end of my drinking where I couldn't play anymore. And I'd played all my life.
I'd played all my life since I was 7 years old, but at the end of my drinking, I couldn't play anymore. I literally couldn't remember how to do it. And that's what it cost me. You know, I ran into this ex-secretary, and I like to tell you this story because it's my experience. And she had been going to AA meetings, and she didn't drink anymore. But she took Quaaludes and smoked pot, and she loved AA. She had a great time. Wonderful people, really. There's a line in that book, As Bill Sees It, and it's my only page number. It's on page 31, and the line is, "There's no waste in God's economy." And that's been my experience. And this goofball, who didn't drink anymore, smoked pot and took Quaaludes and went to AA meetings, saw the signs on the wall. The 12-step signs to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And she'd see newcomers in meetings that looked a lot like me in those days. You know, the ones that come in on the bus with the little white wristbands? I was fat from drinking, and I had soulless eyes, and I was sweat all the time. When I was 2 weeks sober, somebody said, "You'd be cute if you had a towel, because I just sweat all the time." But she looked at me, and she... Now my only prayer, I quit smoking pot, because I really think pot caused me a lot of problems. And I quit smoking. I was just trying to drink and not fall down while the sun is up. I was keeping it simple. That was it. That was a good day, you know. And she was smoking a joint, and she was watching me. And she, and God used it, just, "You ought to try AA." "It's heavy." She was right. It is heavy, you know. But, you know, he planted a message, and I kept going. I was appalled at that. I didn't want to go to AA and smoke pot. What a terrible idea, you know. It's like, who wants to do that? And I just, all I wanted was, I knew I was coming back. You know, the delusion that somehow, someday, I knew I was coming back. I knew I was going to be able to drink again. I knew I was going to play again. And I never did anything. And that's what happens to us in the end. We just live in this strange, sodden, deluded state. I just know it. It was all in my head. Because the reality, I was just chipping away. I was just getting lost. I was dying. And I lost the rounds that I had with alcohol. I just kept losing them. I got a black eye. I got a split lip once. I called AA, and they talked too much. And it was like they didn't listen to the great I am. And I thought, you know, man, this is... And finally one morning, I said, "There were long mornings of getting ready to do what? I don't know what, but it took me a long time to get started." I remember hearing that they had the meeting started at noon, and I thought, man, that's early. You know. How come everybody's up at noon? You know, it's like, so I was out there trying to get started in my kitchen this morning, and my hand tried to run away, tried to run out the window or something. I was like, "Get back here!" And I was like a live fish on the beach, and it was going like this. It was going crazy. I laid it down here, and I held it over my head, and I just went crazy. I gave it a mean look, you know. Oh, yeah. I'd never had a body part disobey me when I was somewhat sober like this. It was like, I willed it to cease. You know what was going on? It was like this moment that was just terrible for me. And this, you know, I don't know if you must have had a moment at the end of your drinking that was just terrible. And it turned out that was the moment. It was just terrible. And all of a sudden, I was just struck tabula rasa. Well, sociologists say it's a blank state, tabula rasa. There was no quacking going on. There was no explanation or rationalization. There was no understanding. It was just blank up there. Turns out to be the moment of teachability. because God sent me a little postcard from the universe. Why don't you call AA again? And I knew it wouldn't work. But I did it. I was getting a lesson in recovery right there. You know, your sponsor tells you something, you know it's not going to work. And you do it and it works. And you go back and you chirp at them, it really worked. Oh, wow. So God told me to call AA again, and I called him again. I said, hi, it's me, and there's more trouble over here. Probably use my other hand, you know. And this time I got a man who was great, and I always believe this, when I share this, it reaffirms my belief in God is very involved with us, and every second, very involved with us. Because when you think about how God, when you're ready, when it's your time, God finds this perfect other nut in this program. There isn't a computer program in the world that could do that. Figure that out, right? Because we're all nuts. And this was my experience that morning. And this guy was great. And he must have really worked his 11th step, praying for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. Because what he did was so important for me. And that was that he listened to me. You know, God bless the people that answer the phones, man, because the people like me call up. But this guy listened to me, and I'm a broken performer. All I know how to do is perform. So he listened to me perform. He didn't come through the phone and tell me, yeah, I was an alcoholic, I better get to the care unit, live and let live, oh, easy does it. He didn't come through with any cliches or easy talk. He listened to me, you know, and that was what I needed. But periodically I'd have to breathe. That's when he made his move. And he said, with all the love in the universe behind him, he said, sounds like you need a meeting. Sounds like you need a meeting. Sounds like you need a meeting. And that was what I needed. You know, the kind of acceptance, no holier than thou attitude, no axes to grind. No lectures to be endured. You know, one more sentence and I might have died. And I tell you though, I said, okay, where's your meeting? I had a big black eye. I put a lot of makeup on my other eye, so my eyes matched. I wore clothes that could have gone on their own if I'd given them directions and money, you know? And they came out of the Hollywood Hills and resented you for knowing I was new. I really couldn't figure out how you knew I was new. I really thought that was weird. You know, here I am, this deluded, broken performer, alcoholic, terrible woman, just crazy, and there you were. And I always think of this first meeting as it's a crucial event, isn't it? The first meeting. It's like, it seemed to me I had this like Fellini movie hangover going. So it just seemed to me that everyone was very squeaky clean and all kind of pink and white. It was just terrible. I'd never seen anything like it. It just wasn't cool. And but I tell you what I'd never forgotten was it's time for another theory. It's been a while since this is another one of my theories. This is a 12-step theory. Because I don't remember what anybody said that day, but I do remember what I saw. And I saw the woman leading the meeting, and I can still see her right now in my mind's eye, because she was so beautiful. And it wasn't the Lancome special. She was so beautiful because she was in the middle of the deal. And she was just looking around in the middle of the deal, and she was leading this meeting, and she was happy being who she was, being where she was, doing what she was doing with the people she was doing it with. And I was never like that. And so I never forgot her. And you don't know who's watching you right now. How's that for paranoia? You don't know. We really are sometimes a copy of the big book that the newcomer is reading. It's very important. I was very sick and I couldn't speak at all, but I could see and I saw this. And it brought me back the next day. I went on my last drug. Went to one of these gay guys' pads and was drinking with him, and he looked up at me and said, "You've really got a drinking problem," and you know, I just quit. And I came back the next day, and that was June 20th, 1976. And I'll tell you, I had the crazy brain and the divided heart of the newcomer. And I wasn't sure. In Los Angeles, June is sometimes overcast. So I had a meeting directory, but I didn't know. Maybe I needed a tan. So I wore a bikini to my first meeting, just in case. With the eye and the fat hanging around. It was a woman's meeting. And I sat in that room and I didn't know what was going on, but I saw how well we are when we're together. This power, you feel it, and I saw it, and you feel it when you're new, when it's time, you hook into this thing, and there you were. You know, and they passed the 12 steps and 12 traditions book to me, and I couldn't say, they wanted me to read, I thought, my name's Nancy, you know, I mean, I had trouble knowing my own name. I was 4 days sober, someone asked my name, and I just really didn't know what it was. That's, wait a minute. Wait. And they wanted to say I'm an alcoholic. Well, that's a lot of language when you're new. Alcoholic. I've been speaking cool for years, and that's only four words. Three of them are wow. So I'm so recovery is all these polysyllables, you know, anonymity, gratitude, serenity. What happened though was this, after the meeting, a woman walked out beside me, no holier than thou attitude, and she was so pretty and nice. And she reminded me of my sisters, and she just walked beside me and gave me her phone number. I never called it, but it was sort of, I think about it sometimes. I mean, how many times do we give out our phone numbers? You know, you give it 1,000 times, and this one person calls at 2 a.m, and that's it. Start work on your 2,000. But you know what? It doesn't matter, because it's just a little gift of love every time, because, you know, that happened then. It doesn't matter. That's what we do for us. To stay sober, we give that out. We give that phone number out. You know, when I had 7 days of sobriety, my ego came back, and I knew all about AA. I figured it out. I figured out how to fix the meetings and improve the way we do things, and how to fix the book, which is so poorly written, and so forth. And I knew that as soon as I got my speech back, my ability to speak back, I could really help you guys. And I was kind of fond of you, and mostly I knew how to go to meetings. If the meeting started at 8 o'clock, I get there at 7:59. It reduces the "are you new" question and so forth. So, and I went, and I hated meetings that sounded like they'd be good for me. You probably have some meetings with pretty nice names, like Finding God Through the Steps and Come With Us and Happy and Joyous. I hated things like that. I like to go to meetings that sounded like bars, and they had one in Hollywood at Joe's Place. Yeah, sounds right. So I went to Joe's Place. You know, it's amazing with women in recovery like me. We come in with this tough exterior, and it's like a marshmallow inside, and then that turns around. And as you get sober, the outside softens and the inside gets a little more resilient. It's a kind of an inside-out experience. Anyway, I went to Joe's place. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. I got there at 7:59. There was only one chair in the back by the door, and it was empty, and there was a little guy in the chair next to it. I thought, he won't hurt me, so I sat down in that chair. And I had my seven-day ego, and I turned to him, and I said, I have 7 days. And he looked at me, and he said, would you like to be our first speaker? And God is bringing in the broken performer. Because I thought, boy, would I. Well, and I instantly created a show, a performance for it. I instantly created, you know, it's going to be dazzling. Guess who's here? The lifeblood of the program. You ain't seen nothing yet. You know, pull you in and push you away. He's going to dazzle. I was making all these talks in my head just while I'm reading chapter 5, right, you know? The format of the meeting was they had a carry the message speaker, 45 minutes speaker, and they had a token newcomer, and I was that token newcomer, you know. So I'm making my speeches in my chair, and so I'm great, you know. And they call my name, and I got up to that podium, and I said, I miss my booze and pills and pals, but I guess I'll keep coming back. And my brain went, no! No! Tell them I can't. It was awful. And they went, yay! Oh, yay! And I thought, what is that? What is that we do here? And I had to come back, you know, and that was, I had to come back. And I was like the title of that book, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Never read the book, but I always liked the title, you know. And Spy Who Came In From the Cold. It's mine. And I had to thaw out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, and I remember when I was 4 months sober really knowing I was an alcoholic all the way down to my toes. And it happened when I heard that line from Dr. Silkworth's letter where he says, alcoholics are the only class of drinkers who, when they drink a little alcohol, develop the phenomena of craving. Doesn't that make you sound? Man, I heard that, and I thought, wow. And that was when I dialed in for the first time. Wow. They know about that. You know? Wow. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, little things that keep you here. I remember when I was 55 days sober, coming to in the back of the room, and some goof like me was up here just, blah, blah, blah. And I came to in the back there, and I was laughing like we did, laughing from here, laughing from the root of me, laughing from my center. I hadn't laughed like that since I was a baby. And that was when I realized I'd lost my laughter in the bottle, too. You know, the first time you laugh sober, you realize you'd lost that too. And then stuff kept happening. When I had 82 days, I got one of those unwritten great promises of sober life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to meetings for 81 days, and I didn't know there were any other newcomers in the meeting. I was so surprised when somebody took a cake with me when I had a year. Oh, really? You were here? Well. Self-centeredness, you know. But I mean, I went to meetings for 81 days, and if you didn't like really keep my attention and promise me money or something, I didn't know what you said. It was all about me, and I had 82 days, and I just came out of a noon meeting, and I was standing around on the steps, and I again experienced this miracle that comes to us. And we're working on when we keep coming to meetings and we keep trying to work these principles. That comes, I started to feel okay. And I really had never felt okay. I was just standing around after this meeting outside of the Radford Club in Studio City feeling okay. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. And you got to be feeling okay when that happens. And just because I was in that state, I looked over here about 20 feet and I saw her. This young woman. I wouldn't have seen her, but I saw her. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And she had stringy hair. And she was wearing an old t-shirt and her jaw was shut like this. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I saw her. My feet took off. I got up there. My hand went out, and you know what I said? Hi, I'm so grateful to be sober. Are you kidding? God, how did that happen? Alcoholics Anonymous did for me in 81 days. What the priest could never do. And the therapist could never do. And my mom could never do. I saw another human being who needed something I had. And I gave it to her for free. Man, that's a big deal. What you and I do is very, very important. It's been very, very important to me. Throughout my sobriety. You know, and I jumped in the pool that day of recovery and of action. And I've worked the steps a lot. That was my first year working the steps. I remember the first time I shared my inventory with my sponsor. And you know me, I'm quack, 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 self-centered. And I'm driving over to her house to share this inventory and thinking, I've been to therapists and I've been to priests and I can do this, no big deal. And I have these pages about myself and my resentments and my hinky little fears and all this. And I'm driving over there to share this with her, and the great I am is in charge. And I go up into her lovely sunny apartment, and the sun is streaming through the French windows, and the cat is stretched out on an Indian rug, and there's teacups on by the sofa, and the scene is set, and all the love in the universe is in the room right then. And I look down at the papers in my lap, and she leaned over and she said, "It's better out loud." This gentle, powerful love that binds us like nothing else I've ever seen. You know, what first appears to be a flimsy reed turns out to be the powerful, loving hand of God. You know, in that day, I left in that little room with bitterness and these fears and these resentments, and they haven't come back. Other ones have. You know, and I left there and I began to experience the promises after step five that talk about we begin to feel at last like we're on the broad highway when we start taking action. We're a part of something. And it's something that needs us and loves us and appreciates us and accepts us. And man, isn't that what we always wanted? You know, and I began to experience that. And that is great, isn't it? You know, I used to pay $100 to think that was going to happen. $100 an hour, listen to me, you know. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't buy this. It's not for sale. You know? We already paid our dues anyway, didn't we? Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Right? And the eighth tradition says we are non-professional. And my lovely sponsor took that from me that day as a good member of this program. And I haven't had to go backwards that way. You know, I work these steps to the best of my ability and practice the principles in all my affairs. I got into an AA relationship. I'll be at the meeting tonight. You'll see me there. We went roller skating you know how when you first put on your roller skates, this was our first day we went roller skating, you first put on your skates, you try to stand up, you do this a little bit, some of us. Well, he was doing this and he said, "You're not going to hold on to me, are you?" And I thought, "I love you." And the next day we moved in together. Now I was an AA couple. Did you hear that pronoun? I was an AA couple. And I was young when I got sober, you know, and I was looking for what was I besides an alcoholic? I mean, I had no idea what I was besides an alcoholic. I never had known. And there's a book by Tobias Wolff called A Boy's Life. He actually writes in there, any image of myself, no matter how grotesque, had power over me. And lack of power has always been my dilemma. And what am I? And so I would be a couple. So I started to be a good couple. You know, we moved down to Laguna Beach when we were in our third year of sobriety. And we lived down there and I made a house. How do you do that? How do you be a couple? You know, we weren't getting along too good. We woke up one day, we're not getting along very good. Let's get married. And I'm running around sponsoring people, yeah, and working steps and talking on the podium and so forth. You know, let's get married. So we called Reverend Wright. He used to advertise in the Penny Saver with a little rag that comes on. His ad was, you figured it out. Married today, call Reverend Wright now. He had a little mustard on his tie. So. You know, God was trying to help me, but I just took so much help, and then I had to run away and go do it my way, you know. And so we got married, and a year later, my husband was drunk, and it was the worst pain of my sobriety when I came home and found him that day. And, I mean, it was painful. I was hurt for me too, and him, and this deception, this park statue we were trying to maintain that we were a couple. It just hurt all over. And then I went through, I got off the podiums in my fifth year of sobriety, and I started working the steps more and again and deeper and more realer, and I by this time I used to say I lost all my money. I spent it. Language clears up around here, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But anyway, I spent all my money, and husband was gone, and I had the ubiquitous garage sale, and I moved into a little studio. It was a renovated garage in North Laguna Beach, and I began to practice the 11th step, and I began to really work this program because I lost my stuff, and I had to. I became a house cleaner. I tried to have a regular job once, but I got a job as a receptionist for a while. I was 5 years sober, and I worked. But they wanted you to show up every day at 9 and wear a dress and be nice. Could not do it. So I started cleaning houses. I'm cleaning houses and talking to myself. You know, I can't go back to music. I'm just cleaning houses and talking to myself. I started listening to talk radio for those other voices. And I started hearing about the world, that there was stuff going on. And I started having opinions. You know how we love that. Listen for 10 minutes and you've got an opinion. Never heard of that issue before, but now here's what I think. And you know, I'm cleaning around listening. And that was very important to me, and as a result of sobriety, because, you know, I had to learn how to listen. I had to learn everything about being a person in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to learn how to listen. And then I didn't make much money as a house cleaner because I wasn't very good. But I heard that you could get money if you went to college, and finally, I got back to school. I periodically went back to school. Once I went to be a hairdresser, but I couldn't even part my Gloria head, so that didn't last more than 2 weeks. And I kept going back to college taking typing, but it's so boring, I kept dropping out, so I had all these W's on myself. Now I've got all these W's,
on my college transcript and my high school transcript says D stop. You know, there's a little tiny music scholarship in there, but the rest of it's like, ah. But I needed money, so I went back. I was finally teachable. And I had finally learned how to go to meetings and how to sit in front and ask questions, be on time and keep a commitment. So I learned to go to school by going to AA meetings where you show up no matter what, with or without your homework finished. And my brain caught fire. What was left of it, I loved school. I started learning about art and literature and science and politics and other people. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I stood up, you know, and I cleaned my way, house cleaned my way through my bachelor's degree, and then I got a job in the university writing center, and I put on a dress, and I started to show up because I learned how to show up and be accountable. I became a college English teacher in 1990, and I started teaching, you know. And it is so much fun. And they don't know, but I run my classroom like meetings. We have commitments. Everybody shares, you know. And you might be the only copy of the Big Book that somebody ever sees. You know, I believed all those old timers in my early days when they said, you know, it's easy to be sober in a meeting, but you got to do the deal the other 22 and a half hours. You know, and so that's the way it is in my classroom and in my work. And you know, in 1994, my mom got cancer, and I got to serve my mom. And I was teaching summer school in Orange County and driving back to Glendale on the weekends to take her to chemotherapy on Friday and hang out across the little kitchen table on the weekends and like to hear her story. I knew how to do that now because you taught me how to do that. And I got to midwife my mom back to her dad and our dad, and my sisters were there. We got to do this. And I can never repay that because that isn't the real me. The real untreated me just runs for the hills when things get close. But because of you, I was able to hold her hand. And when she went back to the happiest time in her life because the cancer went to her brain, she went back to when she was a young married 30-year-old with the husband going shopping, and she was going on these shopping trips. And I held her hands and I sat on the bed and I played the other parts because you showed me what love is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when she died and they carried away, the AAs came and they were all around me, and I don't remember what they said, but they were there like you're here. Remind me of the truth, who I am and what I got to do and how I have to live in this moment. You know, and then my mom left me a little money, and I went back to Glendale, and I bought a little house in the foothills of Tahunga, and I moved back to Los Angeles. And one day my phone rang, and it was the bass player of Sweetwater. Now I remember when I was 11 years sober, somebody said, why don't you sing again? And I said, no way. What did I know when I was 11 years sober? The phone rang and it was the bass player of Sweetwater. Now, there's only three of us alive. I'm sober and the other two are earth people. They've just never had any interesting diseases to speak of. In fact, Freddie, the bass player, has always gone to Mass. He was an embarrassment in the 60s on the road, believe you me. And he remembers everything. Would you like to get back together again? And I thought, oh man, you know I believe I would. So we got back together again, and we're back with all these other people that are back, and we got some new guys to fill in the spaces where the other guys who have died, and we started playing, and the AAs have come along on this journey with me.
because I don't believe in any separation in my life, because it just has to be the principles in all my affairs. You know, sometimes my students come to the Whiskey or the Roxy, and the AAs will come and drink tons of designer water and have a really great time, and then like a happy gaggle all leave together, and the club owners go, "What's that?" Great, great. You know, and so there's this rich thing about living in that you don't know, you may have lost something. I don't know who's here tonight, but you may have lost something and you think it's over. You don't know that. I thought I'd never sing again. I thought I'd never make music again. You know, but what did I know? You know, this program, there are promises written and unwritten in this fellowship. And the one thing they promised me, if you want to drink and go to hell, you'll go by yourself. But if you want us to walk with you through sobriety, we'll walk through everything with you. And these alcoholics mean it. Anyway, I've talked way too long, but it's quite a plane trip, so. I just want to leave you with a great big thank you, and I love you very much. Thank you.